We'll resume on question 123. Question 123 concerns my views and those of General McNair and others as to the organization of Rangers. I favored this in a way, but felt that it had to be handled with considerable care. The first Rangers, in effect, were the special unit or units that we organized for a possible operation on dropping them on a glacier in Norway when we were trying to get at the destruction of what was a heavy water plant of the Germans, meaning something leading up to the atomic energy proposition. The reasons against the special units is quite well understood. They had exactly the same battle in Great Britain. Mr. Churchill was warmly disposed towards the special units, and the head of the ground army training in England was very much against it. Mr. Churchill referred to them, these special fighters, as the dull mass. I mean, in contrast to the special fighter. He referred to the general organization as the dull mass of the army, and the special fighters as just what they were, the Rangers or whatever we choose to call them. When we had no longer the necessity of holding them in Norway, then the question was what we were going to do with them. And they performed a magnificent service in the Anzio battle to retain that salient when it was under the beachhead, when it was under heavy attack. I've forgotten just now all the places we tried to use them, but there is a very good place for them, but there's always opposition because it takes good men, and to that extent it would take them away from the other organizations of the army. The thing could be easily overdone, and it'd have to be handled, I think, with discretion. But it serves as sort of a model as to what you can get. And it also points out what is the great advantage in having a volunteer service, which the Marines and the Navy and the Air Corps enjoyed. We later on organized airborne divisions in which everybody in it, as I recall, was a volunteer from the already enlisted army. And I think their performance and their discipline, their fighting dash, was excelled by none. In fact, I hardly think it was equaled by virtually any other troops. I'm talking about the 82nd Division and the 101st, I believe, and several other special units of that character who rendered such magnificent fighting records in France and Germany, I believe. It's rather odd, though, that exactly the same fight was being made in Great Britain, with Mr. Churchill backing these units. I do not want, under any circumstances, to have him quoted publicly as referring to the rest of the army as the dull mass. Be very careful about this, please. 124. I do not recall about the airborne unit. I think it was a gradual development. I knew I was very much in favor of it. You speak in the question of General Maxwell Taylor coming back to see me on the subject of the special units, General Ridgway having sent him back just at the time of the bulge. I think I earlier referred to this in saying he was sitting at my desk when we got our first information regarding the bulge attack, and he left instantly and, as I recall, went directly to the airport and flew to back to France. . 125, the greatest problem for the wartime training. I don't know. The greatest problem was to continue long enough with the basic training, of which they were all impatient. And it is dull, it is long, and it is very strenuous. And unless it's well done, thoroughly done, the troops are going to be lacking in discipline and performance from that time on. And yet it's very hard to have them see the reason for it. I remember I had some special professional fact gatherers for me. And one of the interesting facts was, the file records up there will show it, that they saw the men in training in this country and talked to them about what they thought of the training, whether they thought it was too much, too little, of the right kind, and so forth. Then they found these same men on the front after they'd been engaged, and they found almost everything the man objected to in this country over there, after a brief experience, he said there was not enough of. The men can never understand how intense this must be in order to register in long drawn out engagements and over the severities of a battlefield experience. But it was rather striking that the very same man that opposed it so in his criticisms in this country, when our fact finders found them, professional fact finder found them abroad, and he looked them up purposely, he found that they then said the very thing that they got the least of, that they objected to most in this country, they now felt they did not get enough of. The training, the infantry training rather than the artillery training, the infantry training rather than the tank training, is a very trying thing. It's a very monotonous thing. But I repeat again, it's a very trying thing, and very arduous, and not anything spectacular about it. So that the men naturally object to it. And I found that particularly true with the National Guard units, though this was really due to their own leaders not realizing the vast importance of it. There was also the problem of the land, because the training of ground units with their tanks, artillery, and other things of that nature requires a tremendous area of ground and will do a great deal of destruction to crops and things of that nature. So that is hard to arrange. At first it is very difficult to get the money from Congress, and I had to have several special hearings in order to get enough money for the large maneuvers. Senator Burns was very helpful in this, and I think one of my hearings with the chairman of the Appropriation Committee of the House, the military section, he was a banker from upstate New York. Senator Burns arranged it, and I saw this man alone. And Senator Burns, as I recall, had my discussion to this representative printed and distributed, given a wide distribution, in order that others might read it and see what the arguments were for the expenditure of these large sums of money for this training. And they were very large sums. But I thought that was one of the most important aspects of the matter, that for once at least America was going to go into the battle with thoroughly trained ground troops. Wasn't much trouble getting the air trained. Wasn't a great deal of trouble getting the artillery trained, because you could fix very carefully what the things were to do, and they didn't involve such arduous service, except for the spotters, I might call them, the officers commanding units that had to go to the front and be with the ground units in order to report the necessary firing points. And there's
observation.
Their observation detail, generally the battery commander. I'll repeat again, the maneuvers were not only valuable, but they were invaluable. We never could have made our way in Europe without these. Matter of fact, our units, after they'd been in Great Britain for a time, lost in training, because you couldn't train over there extensively. You'd have destroyed too many valuable crops. And the leaders always claimed they landed in France or wherever it was, or Italy or Africa, at a less high training standard than they had left the United States. Question 127 regarding the selection of Eisenhower. I had met Eisenhower a long time back. I'd wanted to get him to Benning as an instructor for me before the war. I knew of his qualities, and he'd been with General Pershing for quite a long time. And I followed him when we started in the organization of the Army, And I knew of his work as chief of staff to General Kruger. And I knew also the doing the maneuvers that you refer to, that he had done an excellent job for General Kruger, all of which bore on his selection by me. I would say this, that if he had not done a good job with General Kruger, it wouldn't have taken him. But I was looking at him before he ever got to that point in the development of the Army. 128, I was partly responsible for the development of these special units. I don't remember very clearly about the Norwegian unit or the Austrian unit and the like, but I remember very, very distinctly about the Japanese. We had a battalion in Hawaii. The our commander out there, I think it was General Heron, urged that we use these fellows. And the prejudice against them, of course, back on the West Coast, California in particular, was very strong. So I offered them to, I did, first place, I knew it was quite unwise and quite unfair to send them to the Southwest Pacific, where they'd be in contact with their own people, the Japanese Army. It'd be too hard on them in every way. So we sent messages to commanders in Europe. Then, as I recall, I may be wrong about this, but as I recall, Eisenhower's staff people declined them. Then I offered them to General Clark, and his reply was, "We'll take anybody that'll fight." So I sent this battalion over to him, and then we organized another one in California, and we finally built this up into a regiment. The battalion that we first attached, the division that we first attached this battalion to in Italy, were opposed to it. Their prejudice was so deep against the Japanese. And the next turn I found was when I was going to take them away and build it up into a regiment, I had political pressure from Congress not to take this battalion away from the unit that it was then with, who had opposed having it in the first place. I would say about the Japanese fighting men and these units we had, they were superb. That word correctly describes it, superb. They took terrific casualties. They showed rare courage and tremendous fighting spirit. Not too much can be said of the performance of those battalions in Europe. And everybody wanted them on with them in the operations, and we used them quite dramatically in the great advance in Italy, which led up to the termination of the fighting there. I thought the organization of the additional battalions was very essential, because we felt unless we did something about these Japanese in this country, we would have a very hard time afterwards. I don't mean the army, I mean the civil population. As a matter of fact, even with their brilliant performance abroad, some communities rather blackballed the men when they came home as veterans. .129. The fighting quality of the American soldier has to be measured by several ways. In the first place, a man's fighting quality, his stamina, his relentless purpose, comes most strongly from the association with his home and his family. And any American fighting near his own door sill will display exactly that same spirit. Our great difficulty was that the men were all far from home. They were far from the issues. They were thousands of miles from their home in the Southwest Pacific, in Italy, in Africa, in places they'd hardly ever heard of. And there was none of that tremendous spirit that comes from defending your own home, your own wife and children, such as would fall to the French soldier in particular, and to the others somewhat the same way. The fighting of turn it off of men far from home could seldom reach the effectiveness of that close to their homes, close to the issues, close to realization of what it's all about. That was one of the reasons I thought it was so vitally important to have the Army educated as to what we were fighting about, because it is all done far from home, and always will, so far as we were able to carry out our policy of keeping the fighting out of continental United States. That imposes a very great difficulty. That imposes a great problem of morale, because a little detachment up in the Pribilof Islands, or in the Himalaya Mountains, in Burma, in Africa and all, has to be handled with a certain spirit. However, in all of this, a great deal depends on the monotony of the thing. You know, fighting as a rule is a very monotonous thing unless you're on a grand rush like Patton's move through France. That seldom is the case. And it's the monotony that is very hard to endure, and it's the monotony that has very evil effects on morale. And particularly when you're far removed from home, when you've been in the affair a long time. I found when I went over to Africa that after the successful battle in Tunisia, that some of the regiments, some of the divisions had been led to believe, very unfortunately, that they now should go home. Well, that wasn't possible, because if we used the Tunis to get them home, we'd never get the other troops over, and we'd never be able to build up a command. So it was a very difficult thing, even with the old non-commissioned officers at first, when they assembled there in Africa getting ready for the operation in Sicily, to take in the fact that there was no go-home to this till the war ended, and there was no possible way to manage it unless you got wounded. We'd do everything we could for you while you were there, but you couldn't be sent home for a rest trip. Out in the Southwest Pacific, with malaria as it was, and with the conditions of shipping as it were, we did send troops to New Zealand, and I think some to Australia, because they couldn't get ahead in their malarial condition without a real rest up. But over in Europe, our struggle was to get troops there as rapidly as possible to accumulate them prior to the prospective invasion in Normandy, as it turned out. And yet morale suffered very heavily in Africa at one stage by reason of the rumor spread that these men were to go home, and then we broke faith with them and we didn't send them home. I know I talked to non-commissioned officers of my old division, the 1st Division, and tried to explain to them that the thing was just out of the question. It was hard, but you couldn't help it. And I was always struck with the British troops that took the long, indeterminate periods in Africa, near Cairo, and near Cairo, that spoils the whole meaning. The way they accepted the very hard life they had to lead, and the long time they were away from home, and the heavy fighting they had to do, and the losses they had to accept. The Japanese were a more spiritual fighter, if you accept Buddhism as being a spiritual basis for the fighting. They were all dedicated to the thing. Their lives were involved, and they expect to give them up. They could not surrender. They were desperate in the defense of their leader. And they were very well trained, as there was plenty of time to train this army, which was you can call it a conscript army. I don't know about the Austrians, the Norwegians, and I wouldn't care to comment on the Austrians and the like, as you express it. The British fighters were very stolid in some respects, very determined, and accepted discipline without question, as far as I could see. This is particularly true of the troops off in Northeast Africa. The Germans are natural fighters. We must accept that. They're natural warriors, and they were very highly trained, very ably trained, particularly in their non-commissioned officers. And the basis of their discipline was unbending. And the thing you would find most effective with the Germans was that if you left a sergeant with a few men, he fought like he had a lieutenant general in command, isolated. Too often our fellows when they were new at the game, would think that somebody else ought to come right away and reinforce them or take over, and they would tell the press so accordingly. However, when the time came, such as the Battle of the Bulge, when they got going in that, not the first surprise, which is a new division, they displayed magnificent fighting characteristics. They always would under proper conditions, but they're far from home, and the ordinary military quality is not dominant in America anymore. It's no longer the question of taking the gun down off the mantelpiece and fighting against the savages. So often you would see newspaper accounts in the early days, particularly the First War, that these men were natural woodsmen and everything. Well, a good many of them had never seen woods except in the national park or city park. And all of that had gone with the Indian and with the development of the West. And, of course, the development of the East in the earliest days. The Russian, I think, was... I wouldn't say he was an intelligent soldier in any way, but he had the courage to go ahead, though he didn't understand at all why I was going. He accepted the leadership, if it was anywhere decent, and took terrific losses, and accepted blindly lots of mismanagement. Later on, when the leadership vastly improved, particularly after the Russian Tsaristic army broke up, they displayed more individual efficiency than they did in the early stages. But I would say in one sense they were dependable, because they'd do what you led them to do and not argue about it, as far as I could tell. With us, you had to feel that all your soldiers were readers of Time magazine and editorials from other sources, and had listened to all the newspaper men, and all of those had to be met in this army of democracy. But it was a magnificent army when it reached its full development. I remember Eisenhower asking me to come over before it began to demobilize in order to see it as it was, and I don't think you could have found a better, more powerful army in the world than we had in France in 1945. But it takes a long time to make such an army. It's a long time to get the necessary leaders, because the subordinate leaders are so important, and so few of those were of regular origin. But the whole army was, meaning a variety of numbered armies, was imbued with a tremendous fighting spirit and was remarkably well led. We had some of the most efficient army commanders and division commanders and corps commanders that we've ever heard of, except maybe in the last year of the Civil War. Before going on to the next list of questions, I want to register several comments and, in a way, questions. In the first place, I'm dictating this without a mass of records about me and without secretaries and clerks to gather the papers and look at the facts and find them for me before I talk. I'm doing this out of hand, off the cuff, as it were, and it should be, so far as the sources are available, to be checked for that reason. But you must be very careful not to just publish in any way a broadcast or arrange for later of publication just out of hand what I say here, speaking off the cuff and at considerable length, and of course at times when I'm a little bit tired. I'm covering a vast bit of ground in a very short time. I would say that if a critic was analyzing this and particularly was desirous of finding charges against me as to why a lot that I say should be ignored, he could very readily pick up the names that I don't remember, and say that if my memory is as poor as that, how could I be trusted to this offhand dictation of a lot of facts which are of great importance in interpreting what really was going on at the time in the war. Well, that name problem is almost entirely one of a certain habit that one has when they start to mention a person's name and they've had it in their mind one minute and they've lost it the next, which I've always had. And I still have, and maybe in a little bit greater degree than
formerly. My memory is just about the same, but Mrs. Marshall and I both have trouble remembering this name and that name. Like the other day, I was studying over Senator Vandenberg. Well, there's no political leader that I knew better than Vandenberg, and no one of whom I have more vivid recollections than I have of Senator Vandenberg. And yet I was fishing around here for his name. The last time I dictated, I was reaching for the name of the atomic plants, and I couldn't remember either one. Well, they were just printed on my brain for a long time, and I still haven't remembered the name. I've got Oak Ridge all right, but I still haven't remembered the name of the one out on the Pacific, on the Columbia River, that we had to build out there. I'll remember it in a minute or two, I would guess, but I've forgotten it for the time being now. I'm somewhat regarding names in some places, in the position of the person who said, well, I remembered that until you spoke of it, and you knocked it right out of my mind. So that, I do not think, should be taken as an example of my uncertainty. The fact that I always fish for the name, and you find it for me, is evidence enough that I'm getting at the real fact of the case. To go back to that atomic question, I might add here that in the location of these atomic plants, maintaining the secrecy of what we're doing, they had a great deal of difficulty because the necessities of such a plant were such that it made a very difficult problem of selection. You had to have plenty of water. You should have had cool water. And for that reason, we took the Columbia River. Now, that was very unfortunate in one respect, because out there, there was a labor shortage. And yet we came in there in a region where there was not much labor available and located a plant which demanded a tremendous amount of labor. Now, the civil official who was in charge of such matters for the president came to me and, in a sense, rebuked us not mildly against putting this plant out there on the Columbia River, though he didn't know what the plant was for, without consulting them. Well, they couldn't very well consult them without telling what we were doing. And I just had to sit silent and take the beating. When, as a matter of fact, we had to have an unlimited water supply, and it ought to be cool water if we could get it. And I believe we lowered the temperature of the Columbia River some degrees, I've forgotten what, of the water that passed through the plant and then was wasted into the river again on the other side. We had quite a problem with the labor situation at Oak Ridge. And again, we couldn't explain just what we were doing. We were getting in close to the Tennessee Authority, the TVA, I think they call it. And that was the reason we put it there. There were other reasons why it shouldn't be there. But the importance of it, the difficulty of finding any other suitable place, were such that we had to put it there, and yet we had to do it largely without explanation. So this made it very hard to manage these things, and rather stirred up the feeling on the part of some of those that are looking into the matter that we were pretty dull-witted to do these stupid things without any coordination. Turn it off. Your letter of February 13th came this morning. You asked several questions in it and make several comments, to which I will refer now. The only trouble we were having with the microphone was my voice getting weak. We received all the tapes that you sent or were sent to us.
Also the cleaning fluid.
The plant that I was trying to refer to, that you got with the word plank, P-L-A-N-K, it actually was B-L-A-N-K. I couldn't remember the name, so I said blank. Actually, it was the plant on the Columbia River. You have to cut it again. Before I go any further, I want to make some comments regarding your statement that you had about reached the end of the war period with these questions. There are a number of things that haven't been discussed, and I would like to mention some of them that occur to me at the moment. In the first place, during the period that I was deputy chief of staff, and General Craig was chief of staff, and Morgenthau was giving the principal leadership, getting planes for the French and matters of that kind, and being on generally very cool terms with Woodring, who was Secretary of War. There were some things developed that I think have a bearing on the question of the mobilization period. In the first place, I found it was very difficult to bring to Mr. Roosevelt's attention our tragic lack in ammunition. I think I've mentioned this once before, but it won't do any harm to mention it again. I remember distinctly when I was telling him how little artillery ammunition we had, how much we had to have, particularly for the 105s and these other lacks in ammunition. And he said, well, you can have plenty of artillery ammunition. The Navy has a plant down here on the Potomac below Washington, and they can manufacture it for us. My Lord, we had plants all over the country before we got through this thing, and the Navy, too. That plant could no more have touched the Army requirements than a small boy could have. However, those were the points of view at that time, when the great strain was the difficulty of getting appropriations, was the difficulty of being charged with promoting war, was the difficulty of getting along in reasonable harmony with the Middle West, and was the fact that we were running up to our limit on the allowed amount of money in the public debt, which was permitted by law. So that was a battle through this period, and at that time the President's mind was almost solely concentrated on airplanes, and with a particular idea of the great necessity that the French and the British would have where they were not to be interfered with by bombing, as we would be free to do that in the United States. Well, it takes longer, we found, really, to train the pilot than it does to build a plane. And we were going to get more airframes, and we were going to get conditions under which we could use them. And I was trying to get a balanced result. Otherwise, to my mind, we were just engaged in a futility. But the trouble was to create in the President's mind an understanding of the ammunition situation. And I remember he was going to Warm Springs. And I had, as I recall, I had stated this case to General Pershing, who was then at the Walter Reed Hospital. And on his last call, as I recall, on the President, he talked about this. Well, General Pershing was not too familiar with the problem and was sort of out of touch, though I saw him about once a week, and also wasn't too strong physically. But if General Pershing said it, that had made an impression on the President. But when he told me what had happened, and he made the familiar remark that Mr. Roosevelt had done practically all the talking, I began to be very fearful of whether or not he had been able to make his point. So I prepared a letter for General Pershing and got his stationery. I dictated the letter, and it was to the President on the grounds that General Pershing, had been too hurried in his call on the President the other day, and he wanted to make certain that the President understood his, General Pershing's, view with regard to the necessities other than airplanes. And therefore, he took the liberty of writing to him since my, General Pershing's, arrival in San Antonio and disturbing the President in his rest period at Warm Springs. And I dictated the rest of the letter stating our tragic munitions situation, all General Pershing telling this to the General and writing it at San Antonio and sending to the President at Warm Springs. So then we sent this letter down by plane to the President, to Miss General Pershing, and fortunately he accepted and signed it and mailed it from San Antonio to the president, and it had a tremendous effect. And we began to get a little ground in the approval of effort to get appropriations for ammunition, and as well as other things that had to be, but that most of all. Well, I just remember this rather intricate procedure that we followed in order to get this going. There was another thing that occurred during the mobilization period. I think about February 41. Our promotion situation in the Army had been, in a sense, on an elimination basis. The only trouble was the eliminated fellow continued in service. So we got an accumulation of colonels, senior colonels, at the head of the Army. In the Navy, they were retired. So they didn't have this accumulation of fellows that still had a desperate hope and still had a real strong feeling against the position in which they'd been placed. We've gotten working down in age to about 54 at that time for a brigadier general, but we had an accumulation of colonels who were in the 60s. And it is very difficult to handle, because if you had any board of any kind with a colonel at the head of it, one of these colonels would be the head of it, and he was the senior. So we ran up against the same block to progress that comes when you use men that have sort of lost their touch. In other words, they've are no longer the vigorous men that they were in their 30s and 40s. So this situation had resulted in the accumulation of large numbers of these senior officers who I felt had were not suitable for combat command. And it was a very embarrassing situation, because no man will agree himself to the fact that he is not quite up to the punch, and certainly his family will not. And yet we had to get ahead and get ahead fast. It took a great deal of imagination. It took a great deal of vigor in order to lead the mobilization of this vast army which we were starting to build up. Now, in that situation, I felt I was greatly embarrassed because of my age, because I couldn't be so aggressive regarding these fellows if I was so old myself. And the whole point was that not everyone of that age is lacking, but it's the average of that age that is lacking. For instance, General Patton was up in years, and incidentally would always talk to me about the age question all the time for fear we'd apply it to him. Well, he was the epitome of vigor and leadership and that sort of thing, but he was an exception, and there were not a great many like him. But this presented a very serious problem and a great morale problem, because an officer of that age, he has a sort of a clientele of younger men about him, and his feelings are passed on to them, and you would build up a very discontented feeling in a large group of officers in the Army who would naturally weld together in opposition to any what they would consider ruthless procedure in eliminating them or retiring them or finding some way to use their services other than with combat troops or vitally important mobilization duties. So it seemed to me the only way that this could be done and not hurt morale generally in the Army would be for me to resign and state exactly my reason, that I thought this was vitally important to be done, and that I was old myself, and therefore I would forfeit my career in the effort to make it possible to do this by a younger chief of staff, and not stir up too much of turmoil and damage to morale. So Hopkins and I went to see the president, and in February, up in his study, and I proposed this to him, and explained exactly why, that I thought that if I did this relieving of people and retiring of people the way it was going to have to be done, and done very quickly, it should be done by a younger man. And therefore, I wished to tender my resignation as chief of staff. And he listened to me and thanked me, and that was the end of it. Talked about something else right away, and a week or two passed, and I spoke to Hopkins again. I said, how about that? Well, he said, the president just laughs at you. He says, no politician ever resigns a job. And that's just talk. And Hopkins told him, no, it wasn't, that I really meant it. I was sincere about it, and I was pressing him to get the president's conclusion. So then I went and saw Mr. Roosevelt again, and I told him again just what this thing was and how important that I thought was to do it. And I explained how I wanted it done, how I suggested it be done. To let me pick the man I thought ought to be chief of staff and get Mr. Roosevelt's approval. Nobody else would know anything about it. I would bring the man into the War Department and keep him there 2 months to put him in touch with what was happening. Then I would send him to Panama. I'd send him to Hawaii. I'd send him to the Philippines. We were just in the mobilization period then. And I would send him even to Iceland. And so that he could get in touch in Alaska, in touch with everything that was going on. Then I'd bring him back to Washington and have him there in the general staff until he became thoroughly familiar with the conditions there, but without guarding as much as I could against any feeling on anybody's part that he was headed for any other job except in the normal routine of affairs. And then the president could announce my resignation and announce the man's appointment all on the same day. Well, I never got any action out of Mr. Roosevelt, as I say, after my second trip with him. And I told him, I told him then that Hopkins had said that it didn't make much impression on him, the president, because he never knew a politician to resign. Well, I told him that wasn't the case at all, that I really had dedicated to try to do this thing. And I had this serious situation in the Army, and I didn't think it could be cured without terrible damage to morale. If it was done by an old man, like I was in years, an older man, I should say, like I was in years, but the issue died there, and my efforts to resign were defeated. I might say that I've been pretty fortunate during the war in selecting commanders, theater commanders in particular, men like General Eisenhower, General Bradley, General Smith, and so on. But my proposed selection to be my successor as chief of staff would have been an utter failure, I learned later. So I was spared that horrible error in judgment by the president not accepting my proposition. Now, there was another factor I wanted to discuss that took place during this mobilization period. And I'm sorry right now I can't remember it, but it covers quite an area of development and of great interest, and I will hand it to you later when it pops into my mind. I had it this morning, but I haven't got it now. Now, as to the fighting quality of troops, 130, did I ever feel that we were weak in the true fighting qualities of ground troops? Until they were thoroughly trained, decidedly so. And we had some issues in Africa that would prove this. But it was through lack of training, not lack of leadership, though there were some mix-ups in that respect, too. It was much easier to train the air and to train the artillery. The general feeling was it is much more difficult, but it was not, because they had something fixed to work with, whereas the ground troops were not in that fortunate position. They had the ground and tremendous areas and the dark and uncertainties in every direction, and therefore, and tremendous fatigue and problems of endurance, which the others didn't have at all to the same extent. Just the fact of an artilleryman having a piece of artillery there gave him a sort of a rallying point. There was nothing like that for the infantry soldier. And most of his fighting was done when he came forward in the dark, never having seen the ground at first, and going into a general confusion of action, which is bound to be the situation almost in any ground combat today. When we had time to thoroughly train them, I thought they were magnificent. But I published an article by a private in a regiment in Africa who was writing up the duties of a reconnaissance platoon. And he went on to explain some of the tragedies that were happening. And he likened it to the fact that the men didn't realize what they were getting into. They didn't realize the brutality of the war. They didn't realize the determination and ruthlessness of the Germans. And he went back to say that these men had probably seen the ruins in London, But they were other people's ruins, and they didn't make much impression on him. He saw them. He knew it had been big bombing and knew it had been a lot of lives lost. But not until the thing landed in his lap did he fully comprehend how ruthless war was, how ruthless the Germans were. And he behaved very badly in some of the early encounters in Africa. Their training was only partially completed, and Rommel's people came at them in a very vicious way and rather surprised him, it seemed. They walked around and displayed themselves, looking at the souvenirs they could get out of a village, while the Germans observed them in their performance and in due time came down on them with ruthless force and savagery. But they quickly got over this, and as the trained divisions arrived, and it takes a long time to complete this training, that disappeared, and they became magnificent fighting men. I don't think you could find any more wonderful fighting than that was done by the troops in the Bulge after the first surprise of this newly arrived division widely scattered in a strange place. No, we didn't use ground air operations properly early in the war. We hadn't maneuvered enough with them. Our planes were too scarce to give us all we needed back in the maneuver areas, and it's very hard to get across air-ground training and have the soldier realize what's to be done, and have the airman in particular realize the importance of what he's trying to do, because he gets no reaction at all in his ordinary training procedure. Therefore, it is very hard to get that properly done. And not till he's been in action does he really get at the training right. Then he gets it. Then he's determined about it. And then he brings every pressure in the world to bear on the air to do their part. And the airman generally responds in a like manner. I felt that we had worked out our problem very well, very, very well, before the war ended. I remember having a German officer, a captain in the German army that we had as a student officer at Leavenworth. He had been in every engagement practically from the outbreak of the war, the first advance into Belgium, up until the final action when he was a prisoner. And he described the reaction of the German infantry to airplanes when they first came up as the German army made its initial advance down through Belgium into France in the First World War. And they did everything wrong. They were misconceived everything wrong. And he had to be very careful about allowing me to print it for fear to get him in Dutch with the authorities back in Germany. 132, the strong and the weak points of the American soldier. I think the first thing is he has to know what it's all about, much more than any other soldier. I think the next thing is there has to be time to get him trained. I think the next thing is we have to have very competent instructors, which we lacked at the opening of the war because they were not available in any number at all. We were taking in at one time every month as many men as there were in the entire United States Navy. Well, we couldn't. We had to do that. We were being pressed to do that. I wanted to slow up on the draft act, but I was told I couldn't politically do that without having it cut off on me. And we just didn't have the instructors. And one of the reasons that I was very loath to expand very rapidly our officer schools at the outbreak of the war, and Mr. Stimson and his friends from the First World War experience were trying to force the issue, was I didn't have enough competent instructors, and I was unwilling to have these men put in there for being instructed when we couldn't line up the necessary number of competent instructors. And it wasn't really until we'd had the reserves in line for about a year until we began to develop a plenitude of instructors, which we didn't have at first. And as soon as I could bring recovered wounded men back from France, that changed the whole complexion of the instructional question. In England, where they were pretty close to the conflict and saw the scars and strokes of some of the conflict. And in France, of course, where they were close up to it, it was quite another matter. Now, when the American soldier knew what it was all about, when he saw the results of his training, as I said before, the very things he objected to in this country were the things that he thought we had not enough of when he was questioned abroad. And also, you have the question of his fighting for a cause that is very remote from his own affairs. You take an Iowa farmer, you can't get a much stronger character than that man. Yet all of this thing was in a distant field from his home, among distant people, and for a cause that couldn't cut it right down to something like an Indian shooting at you or a local army fighting against you. As to coddling the soldiers, I was responsible probably for as much of that abroad, not much of it back here, as anybody, because I felt that we had to do everything we could to make the men feel we had the highest solicitude for their condition of affairs. They were being taken from home, they were being taken away from the plow and their wives and families and everything of that sort, and in a distant country where the fighting was quite desperate, and as I say, the reasons were a little bit remote from them, though I had done everything I could to illustrate those through DeCapra's famous movies. And I felt that we must do all we could to convince the soldier that we were all solicitude for his well-being. I was for supplying everything we could and then requiring him to fight to the death when the time came. You had to put the two things together. If you were all solicitude, then you had no army. But you couldn't be severe in your demands unless he was convinced that you were doing everything you could to make matters well for him. Also, we had the papers going to them, to some extent, and certainly the magazines, and he saw what was happening back in the States. He saw about labor strikes. He saw the high wages of labor. He was losing his job. He was separated from his family. He was risking his life. He was drawing very, very low pay. All the conditions were hardships, and yet here was labor back home getting a very high salary and having all sorts of advantages which were undreamed of among the troops abroad. Therefore, I thought it was quite essential, that the soldier be convinced that so far as we were concerned in the Pentagon or the munitions building or wherever we were doing everything in our power to help him. And I remember when I took over several breweries in France, I thought I'd be investigated for that. That's about the only thing I wasn't investigated for. But they never picked that up. But I saw every brewery we get our hands on was recreated and put into service for our men who like beer. And I suppose now, if this came out, I'd be able to be attacked again. But I didn't get into the production of hard liquor, but I did all the beer that we could possibly manage. I was challenged once about trying to have orange juice for these men. Well, we couldn't have much orange juice. It's bulky and hard to ship. But we got some shipments through, just like we did Thanksgiving turkeys, to have them feel that we were trying to get them what they craved so much in this touch of home. And that was the reason that I had for doing these things. And they responded, I thought, magnificently to that. I went over the post exchanges in France and Italy very carefully. And some of them were models. Particularly, I saw one in Naples. It was a most perfect little shop I ever got into for its kind and in the condition of affairs. But those had to be evidences that you were thoughtful of them, and it might seem like coddling. Now, when they wanted to go home to get a rest and not stay in the fighting, then I was adamant. They couldn't go home. They had to stay right there. When the time came up, they wanted to be relieved from the line. We probably couldn't relieve them from line, and I was adamant again, so far as that is concerned. And they would respond because they felt that you really were trying to do for them. And while they wanted this and were encouraged in those demands, they in the end gave away the sober thoughts and responded the way you wanted them to. When it was written up that we had these divisions in Italy and they were forgotten, well, if anyone can forget 27 divisions, he's got a marvelous forgettery. That hit morale a dreadful blow. A really dreadful blow. And some of the corps commanders told me they didn't know what to do about their troops. They'd gotten obsessed with this fact that we'd forgotten them entirely. Well, of course, the semi-amusing part of this was the troops in Southwest Pacific had exactly that same feeling about the troops in Africa. All the writing was about the troops in Africa and the troops in Sicily, and they felt they were being ignored. Now they were into the fighting, and the troops in Italy were obsessed with the idea that they were forgotten, and this thing just rattled backward and forth. But the great trouble was the way it was approached by some of the press or some particular writers who I will not name. And the battle to maintain morale under those conditions was very, very hard. And it was quite amazing that we got through that as well as we did. But I think the battle in Italy, where they were told that we'd forgotten those divisions there, was one of the hardest of all, and was one of the most absurd. One of the most absurd challenges that you could have gotten. '134, the civil affairs flare up in Italy. It caused us more trouble, but it caused largely to Mr. Stimson, because I didn't concern myself much with it. We had one military official of rather high rank who was in the temporary army and who didn't like something, the way something was going, and he announced, as I understood it, that if they didn't change that, he would resign and come home. And I sent him word by an officer, I didn't put it in writing, by an officer. He wouldn't resign, he wouldn't come home, and I'd put him in the front rank as a private if I heard another damn word out of him. And I didn't hear any of after that from him. At 135, it's a psychological warfare. I don't know about that. We did our best with it, but it's very difficult to be certain that you're accomplishing something. There were tremendous things can be done in psychological warfare. I think the main trouble was we took it, our instructors in the development of all, took it too seriously and tried to do it in a grand way when, as a matter of fact, very little things, psychologically can almost wreck the morale of the army. I just referred to one in the case of Italy. And little moves like that can do more to upset the apple cart than a grandiose scheme, though it's all right to have the plan. But we didn't get very far with the grand planning as far as I could see. '136. At first we had considerable difficulty in dealing with General Donovan and the OSS generally. This was composed of a very fine group of men, a rather brilliant group of men, and it was led by Donovan, who was a very effective soldier and had been a very gallant soldier as measured by his Medal of Honor. But he was also a classmate of the President, and that presented complications right away, because I could deal with all manner of things in one way, but when I ran into a classmate of the President, I may run into a complete stumbling block. I remember in General Donovan's case, I admired him. He was a very able man and been a very brave man and been a very fine leader, and he wanted very much to be commanding general of the 27th Division in New York, and was very strongly opposed by the then commander, who was about to retire or had retired. And I didn't blame him for wanting the job, and I didn't blame the other fellow for his opposition, and I didn't blame any of them, matter of fact, for being quite human. But I took an officer who had a very distinguished record afterwards, and he had to see that Donovan got what he wanted, that we could give him without complicating our setup. I remember he went on trips with him and things of that sort, and he was a very brilliant young officer. This same problem applied to others, and I took the same means to settle it. One of my dear friends and one of the great helpers I had in the war was Barney Baruch, and he was very strongly in touch with the President and could exert a powerful influence. So I had an officer, and I don't mind telling who it was. It was General Bedell Smith, of the later distinguished career as Chief of Staff to General Eisenhower and Ambassador to Moscow and as head of the CIA and Undersecretary of State and so forth. And I detailed Smith to be in touch with Baruch, and he did it very, very successfully, and won Baruch's confidence, and in that way eased my problem, because I didn't have to try to settle so many of these things myself. Afterwards, Baruch rendered me a very invaluable service, which I think I might describe right now, lest I forget it later on. During this mobilization period, during the period we were trying to get these big appropriations through, during the period we were trying to build up the army and all, I think it must have been about April 41, I called in Baruch for very specific services. He would always come in to see me, and would always tell me that he was stood ready to do something for me the minute I wanted done. After he'd see the president, he'd generally come and see me, and then see Mr. Simpson. Well, I didn't have need for his services right then. It didn't pan out quite the way I wanted. And when I used it, I wanted to use it the way that I thought would be most profitable. Well, I had an appropriation in that had been once accepted by the budget committee, which is pretty hard to pass some of these things through. And it had been accepted by the Appropriations Committee of the House. And then on the resumption of the question at a later date, they struck out the committee. The two things that I had in this proposal, which are most important at the time, they were so insignificant in the light of later appropriations that people would not treat it seriously, I don't think, in listening to it. But it was very serious to us when it was very hard to get a dollar. I had 10 or 11 millions in, 11 I think, for Alaska. We wanted to start the defenses of the Aleutian Peninsula, but we had to have some place for our people to weather, to endure this very cold weather. So I wanted to build up at Anchorage a base point, now a very large post, and quite an air base. So I wanted $11 million for that. And I wanted $11 million for Alaska, and I wanted a complement of planes that I could reinforce the army with during the ensuing fiscal year. I just had an increase in planes that the president had got, which is his first great defense effort. But I needed, I've forgotten how many records will show, it was, say, 1,500 or 2,000 planes, whatever it was.